Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Monty Roberts, author of The Horses in My Life, published by Trafalgar Square. In the weeks to come, we have Neil Gaiman reading from his smash hit, Anansi Boys, Carl Hiaasen reading from his funny new novel, Flush, Michael Connelly discussing his best-selling novel, The Lincoln Lawyer, and many more. You can visit www.tatteredcover.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, I see Monty Roberts coming to the podium. It's time to begin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. Our guest tonight is a man on a mission. His message, that you can communicate with horses by winning their trust without having to resort to force. Raised in California, he won his first riding trophy at age 4. He has spent most of his working life as a professional horse trainer. His autobiography, The Man Who Listens to Horses, was published in 1996 and became an international bestseller, staying on the New York Times bestseller list for 58 weeks. He now spends most of each year on the road taking his nonviolent message, Join Up, to a global audience. Tonight he will be discussing and signing his latest book, The Horses in My Life. Please join me in giving a warm Tattered Cover welcome to Monty Roberts.
Thank you very much. We're in the techno age, and they have a little machine down here to do some online thing. And there's a little mic here that takes the voice, so I have to stay right here so that I'm with your mic, which I could walk around with, but also with the other mic so that they have the words for, I don't know who, in posterity, somebody. Yeah, The Horses in My Life. I didn't realize until I got here today that the Tattered Cover, one of my favorite bookstores in the world, and I'm not just saying that because I'm here. I said it on TV today, and I am here, and I flew from Washington, D.C. to come here, and tomorrow I fly to Dallas. And I went from to Washington from Lexington, Kentucky, where another favorite bookstore of mine is, which is Joseph Beth, an independent bookstore in Lexington, Kentucky. And they've been wonderful friends and friends of my books, too. So after the fifth book, you become rather aware of where your audiences are and the places that you need to be aware of and attentive to. And I really have a lot of fans in Colorado. I really have a lot of people here that go the extra mile to try to get my information, and so it behooves me to continue to come back to Colorado as often as I can. I was here a couple of months ago, and I did a crazy thing. It's called Extreme Makeover Home Edition in Colorado Springs. And there's a wonderful family there. Maybe some of you have heard about it, called Barrett, the family Barrett. And this fellow is retiring from the military, and he's raising a lot of children. And they needed space. They had a tiny little house, and the kids were doing well, and the kids wrote a letter and convinced, I think it's CBS, isn't it, that they should have a new house. And so I was there for 5 hours, but I saw rushes or clips, outtakes, where they build this house in 7 days, 24 hours a day, lights on. It's crazy. But it's going to air on October the 2nd. So that you in Colorado should know that. And I might even be still in it if the editors didn't leave me on the floor somewhere. But they had 14 horses on the place, and when I arrived there, Ty Pennington, he looks like he still has his finger in the socket somewhere, was running around a field with a battery-powered megaphone yelling at the horses, "Come in here immediately and get in this corral and load in this trailer or else." And these horses are running around the field in front of him, looking at him like he was crazy. And the first thing he said to me is, "I'm ADD, but my mother's a psychologist." And I guess that made him feel like he was legitimate if his mother was a psychologist. But it turns out he's really a nice kid, and he's on a mission to try to improve the lives of people, and you might find it fun to watch that. I have no idea what's in the final cut. I'm here tonight to talk with you about the horses in my life and to bring you up to speed as to why I wrote it and what it's about. And furthermore, not in bookstores anywhere except the tattered cover and I think a few other selected bookstores, is From My Hands to Yours. And the reason it's not in bookstores is that when you sell a manuscript to a publisher, they own it. And they really can do just about anything they want with it. And they will always tell you that you have the final say. But it seems you never really do have the final say. And they explain to you how much better it would be to have it a different way. Well, this is a textbook. It's not easy reading. It's not something that you go and sit down and enjoy the reading of. It's for hardcore horsemen wanting to learn my techniques. Okay? So we didn't want a word of it changed. And a textbook shouldn't be really edited anyway, I don't think. It should come straight from the teacher or the professor or whatever you want to call it, to the student in the very form that it was meant to come to that student. And not to worry so much about presentation or how it's couched, if you will. This book is a textbook. And I'll start out by telling you a little about it, because some of you asked tonight would I talk about the specifics of my concepts and the hands-on portion of it. This book has 60 divisions or chapters or segments, if you will, and a lot of drawings, about 100 drawings and about 150 color photographs, so that each of my concepts is explained to you in drawings, photographs, and words. It took me a lifetime to write this book. It's hard work. I wanted to buy a book tonight from Tattered Cover, and they insisted on giving it to me. But it's about how to write better. And I picked it up, and there were several things in the first few pages that just intrigued me. And one of the things was that writing is hard work. It really is hard work. Those who would just sit down and call it a fun thing to do, according to that author that I picked up tonight, and myself, they would leave for you a lot of work to plow through the way they want to say it. But it's hard work to get your sentences lean and bring the point across and not belabor a point and not do things just for the dramatic value of them, but to get the information to the reader and keep their interest so they go. And he said something in that book in the early part, that every reader is sitting on a precipice of boredom or even sleep. And it's your obligation to keep them from tipping off that precipice. And so I have taken that seriously, and I try to do it. And my books have been very successful. And it's crazy, because I don't know why they're successful. I never went to school to be a writer. I'm a scientist. I'm a behaviorist. I have 2 doctorates in behavioral sciences. And I'm a serious student in that area. But writing? And Her Majesty, when she said to me, there must be a book, I simply said, Your Majesty, can't we do another video? And she said, not at all. Videos go away, she said. The written word is the only thing that's lasting in our society. And I thought, okay, she's inviting me to come back in the autumn. This is in 1989. And I'll give her 5 or 6 months here, and I bet she'll forget it, you know, and I'll come back and I'll tell her about a great idea I have for a video. And so when I met her in September, I was with her in April the first time, and when I met her in September, the first words were, how are we coming on the book? And I knew then that she was steadfast about it. And Her Majesty had allowed her picture to be placed in several magazines saying there was going to be a book. So what choice did I have? And the funny thing is that she took me to a publisher called Methuen, now out of business, but at the time it was just down the street from Buckingham Palace, and she had some friends that worked in there. It was an old publishing house of textbooks mostly, and it was so funny. I knew nothing about being an author. I knew nothing about having a literary agent to help me or anything. And Her Majesty had other things to do. She had to get back for appointments and stuff, so she said she wanted to just introduce these people to me and tell them that there had to be a book. And then she would go, and I would continue a visit with them and make some arrangements to do business, like creating a book. And she went away, and they took me in the back room, which was, euphemistically speaking, behind the woodshed. And they told me, this book will never sell more than 3,000 to 5,000 copies. We know what we're doing, and it doesn't deserve an advance. And there will be no royalties. It won't even pay for the printing. But if Her Majesty wants a book, we will print a book. And I said, look, if she has one for her nightstand, and I have one for mine, I will be perfectly happy. I never have gone into this thinking there was an advance or royalties at all. So you don't have to worry about that. Well, under those conditions, we're interested, they said. Well, then, a lady who became my literary agent later picked up the manuscript on some series of circumstances that were just crazy. BBC was doing a documentary, and I finally had my video. She knew a lady that was a literary agent. And then she had an auction, and all hell broke loose. And ultimately, they were right. It sold 3,000 to 5,000 copies the first day. And it has sold 5.3 million copies, and as was suggested, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 58 weeks. So this book is not published by any publishers. It's published by Pat and myself. And it is what I wrote, word for word, as which most of them are, but slight editing and shortening and that kind of thing, which is fine for a book that you want to read out of interest. This is a book to learn from. And The Horses in My Life is my 5th book, and I was requested by the publishers to come up with this book, particularly the European publishers. And they came to me. It's been out for a year in England and Germany and Belgium and Holland. And it's like they love it. They really love it. So I'm excited about it. But when they came to me, I said, this is like asking a kid, does he want to go to the candy store? Write a book about the horses in my life? Is anybody else interested in the horses in my life? And they said, oh yes, we think they are. And now, being the fifth book, I had quite a bit of experience. I'm an author now, a best-selling, an international best-selling author. Isn't that something? And I have done three books as audiobooks. Books on tape, they used to be called. But now they're on anything. I don't know how they would. But audiobooks, yeah? So I know how to do audiobooks. I had a director. They hire a director, Random House did. Send him to me. They put you behind a glass, and you have this thing here with the manuscript up there, and you have to slide the pages off without making noise, and it's two pages, and you have to read these pages, but you can't read them like you're reading. You have to tell the story. And this director worked with me for about an hour and a half on 10 pages or something, and it wasn't going as well as it should have, but he never let me know that at all. And he kept saying, "You're doing fine. You're doing fine. Just relax and continue. You're doing fine." And I said, "Wait a minute. We got to stop for a minute. Open the door, because it's a soundproof. You're sitting in a soundproof booth with this glass in front of you. He's sitting on the other side of it." And I opened the door and I said, "I just want to tell you that I've taught writing all my life. And I know exactly what you mean when you say, 'I'm doing fine.' Because I've said it to so many kids that were riding backwards, you know." And so he laughed like heck about that, and it lightened the whole thing up. And I did get better about my books on tape or my audio books. And I enjoyed the next two a lot. In fact, I enjoyed the first one really as I got into it. But one of the things that he said to me during the course of making that first one was, "I want you to elevate your chair." And he had me in a low chair, and then he put me up in a higher chair, and he said, "I want you to look over your manuscript as you just ever once in a while have a chance to just look over there. And I want you to see this jacket I'm putting down on a chair right here. And I want you to visualize that jacket, and it's a little boy, or a little girl if you choose, but it's a child, about 12 years of age. And between you, this light that you see is a campfire. It's not really a light. And you're the only two on the face of the earth. You're on top of a mountain somewhere, and you have a campfire between you, and you're telling this child the story." And I thought, what a genius this guy is, you know. And he sat over there and he clammed up. He didn't say another thing to me. And I told the rest of that book, my story, to this child. And I've been telling stories to children ever since, as I do various things. But when I did this book, I took it one step further. Because they said they wanted a book with about 50 of the most educational horses that I had, the most indelible, memorable horses that I worked with. And I said, "That's great. I don't know if I can keep it down to 50, because I had to leave some horses out that I wanted to put in desperately. There's 52, so I squeezed two more in there. But you do have to draw the line somewhere. And mind you, the important ones, the most important ones are in here. There's no question about that. But anyway, I took it one step further, because when I wrote this book, I didn't write a word. Not a word. I didn't write a word. I had a big beanbag that I had, and a friend of mine sewed cowhide around it with hair on. It's really nice, and it's big. It's as high as that desk, and it's got a lot of beans in it. And you can get on it all kinds of ways. You know, you can sink down in it looking forward, or you can grab it and kind of roll up on it like it was a big ball or something. And that's what I did. And I would start each story, Ginger being the first story, and I would see that child over the lights. And my wife would sit there and put it into the computer. And we went through this book like lightning. And I got to one, I was doing it chronological. First we made an outline and we got a list of all the horses. And they told me, the publishers did, that they wanted me to try to bring to my audience what each horse taught me. And select horses that really did teach me something. They felt that the educational value of the book was there, whether it was a good book to read or fun to read about the horses. The educational aspects were there. And they wanted those important horses to come forth with that information at the end of each chapter. So I had that in my mind as I was doing each horse, and it was unbelievable how educational these horses really were. And you don't stop to think about the things they taught you until you begin to reflect on each horse. And I was doing them chronologically. Ginger, my first horse. Now everybody loves their first horse, that's for sure. And I'm no exception. And Ginger has a very special place in my heart, not just because he was my first horse, but if you remember my first book, if any of you read that, my father was a traditional horseman. And he was traditional about children too, particularly his firstborn son. And I had 71 broken bones before I was 12 years of age. None broken by horses. So Ginger was my protector. He was my wheels. He was my transportation to get me out of there. He was a place to go. He was my educator. He taught me how to ride well because I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea at the time that subliminally I realized that if I was in front of an audience, I was never beaten. If there were people around, there was never any violence. And if it was an audience in competition, he couldn't even say, "Go to your room and wait for me," like he did many times when there were a few people around. But I knew what it meant, and I would quiver and hide. But Ginger would help me. Ginger would teach me how to be better in the competition ring. And the better I was in the competition ring, the more times I was in it. And the further I got to travel. And the more I got to travel and the further I went, the less I got beaten. The fewer things I did wrong when I was first. But I never heard one time, ever, "Good job. Congratulations. That was great." Not once, ever. I don't remember a handshake. Certainly never an arm around or a hug or anything like that. Would be totally out of the question. I could win a major championship, and he might walk right by me and never even say anything. But don't you hate him yet. Because you ought to know what he went through as a child too. And I didn't really learn that till I was later in life. And I didn't know the psychological effect of generational violence. I didn't know what it meant to be imprinted to violence. So tonight you're looking at a violent man who won't be violent. Just like the guy or the woman who drinks too much. They don't have to, and they can go one day at a time with nothing to drink at all. And that's me. I go one day at a time without being violent, and I have since I was 12, 13 years of age. Ginger. So I'm going along chronologically, right? Brownie, my second horse. Mischief, my third horse. Dantac, my fourth horse. And my first national championship in horse mastership, and declared a professional by the American Horse Shows Association in 1950 at the age of 15. That same year, Lex Conley gave me a card for the PRCA. It was called the RCA at the time. But it made me a professional in rodeo, too. And so I slide along here, the no-name Mustang. You got to read about him. Nobody knows where he is. He was in a can and out of it a long time ago, I'm sure. But he might be the most important horse in this book, because he's the first one that told me that he could understand the language and he could speak it back. Bernie won me my first world's championship in bulldogging. Colorado Springs was the finals. Colorado Springs was the finals of both of my world's championships, one in bulldogging and one in team roping. And I go along chronological, yeah? And my wife is helping me, My Blue Heaven, Ron Teza, A Pure Arab. And there's horses in here that cost $40, even maybe less, those Mustangs in the early days. Here's Hey Sam, my first big horse on the racetracks. Bartlett, the first national champion in halter. Fiddle d'Or, two world championships in the Hackamore. Here's Scotty, at the time, the world's leading horse carrying bulldoggers in professional rodeo. That's the first run he ever made in a professional rodeo, right there. And he let me on that steer to be 3-2 at the Cow Palace, the Grand National in San Francisco. It's quite a story, because I was supposed to be on another horse, and I drove all the way from San Francisco to San Luis Obispo to get him after the first go-around, when the first horse let me down, and he was supposed to be the good one. And hazing for me there is Harley May, who's, I think, won 12 world championships. And he owned Scotty, and I was the trainer of Scotty. Now we're getting to a point here, and here's Night Miss, two world championships in the rain cow horse division. And that's the fulcrum. I've just gone by a horse. Who's next? Going along chronologically, yeah? Baruna. Julius Dolan, Baruna. And Pat is saying, you skipped one. No, I didn't skip one. This is what I want to do. And so she just kept putting it into the computer. And the last horse in this book had to be the last horse in this book. I could not do the story of Johnny Tivio until the book was finished. You can ask me all night who my favorite horse was, and I will tell you that no parent can tell you who their favorite child is. But there's a reason that he's not chronological in this book. Johnny Tivio won 4 world championships for me. And he was the most unbelievably generous horse I've ever seen. And he could read and write. He could. And Shy Boy is in here, and how much has he meant to me? My word. Get to know about him. It's just like a family member, that's all. And then Johnny Tivio is the last one. And what is the value of this book to a horseman, then? Or to anybody that wants to read a book? Horses have taught me that violence is never the answer. And the first of those horses, Ginger and Brownie and the no-name Mustang, they were the ones that were saying, my father had it wrong. They were the ones that were saying, if you get us to be a partner with you, not through pain and force and coercion, we'll do more. If we're doing it because we want to, we'll do our jobs better. And who the hell was I to say they were wrong? I mean, if you ask me, would you do your job better if you were doing something you liked to do or something you didn't like to do or something you were being forced to do? Of course, if you liked doing it and you weren't being forced to do it, you would do it better. And the very person that would demand from a horse through violence, walk up there and try to be violent to them and see what happens. You know, when they're clubbing on a horse or tying a leg up on one, or doing the things that people are doing these days, even still. I just had a tour through Spain. And I have to tell you, Some of the things that I saw were just appalling, absolutely appalling. I hardly worked with a horse there that didn't have scars over its nose, deep, like a razor blade or something. Fine scars, but deep, way down in the nose. What is all this? I'm seeing third horse, fourth horse. No, that's from the Sarucha. Sarucha. Sarucha is a saw. Yeah, no, it's a noseband, Sarucha. And it's a metal noseband with teeth on it. It's a saw. And they teach them to lead with this thing. And their nose becomes hamburger when they're babies. Hamburger. And they go out there when they're weanlings and they decide which ones are going to be cow horses. Work on a ranch as cow horses. And if they're going to be a cow horse, they put them in a little set of stocks and they do several things. But one of the things they do is cut their tail right off. Cut the bone right off. They leave about that much. Because they don't want the tail to switch and bang their legs and stuff. And they say the ladies wear dresses and side saddles on the ranches and they don't want them to switch their tail and hit the dresses. And they turn them back out with the most unbelievably biting flies you ever saw in your life. They drive those horses crazy. And the ones that are going to be like the Andalusianos, that they're going to ride in the parades and stuff, and they're going to teach them the high school stuff, they leave the tail on. But they cut all the hair off of it. They clip all the hair off of it. And all those babies from weanling onward go around out there with just a bone until they grow a tail, which is a couple of years before they can switch the flies. And I'm saying, why would you do such a thing? The hair grows back in stronger. What? Yeah, sometimes two hairs grow where, you know, it's a thicker tail. Get out of here. What in the hell ever taught you that? Well, it's the same as with grain, you know. If you cut grain off when it's young, then it'll stool out and come thicker. And it's true for grain. But it's not true for hair follicles. It doesn't work that way. If it did, I'd be cutting mine quick, man. It's crazy. They don't seem to see the fallacies. They don't seem to see the brutality and things like that. And yet, I'm working hard. I'm going about 310 days out of the year to bring my concepts to the rest of the world. And they tell me that about 500,000 horses will be started by my principles in the next 12 months. And that is amazing. If you'd have told me that 15, 20 years ago, I'd have said, you're crazy. If we get 10 or 15,000, it would be good. That's what I would have thought. But it's happening. When they invite you to Spain, and when they take you there, and when they see value in your work, you know you're beginning to change the last of the dominoes that you need to topple. Maybe you got to get to Argentina yet, and Brazil, and Venezuela, and some of those, but it'll happen. It's going to happen. And while I was in Spain, some guys came to me, and they said, there's a guy down the road, his name is the Duke of Albuquerque. He's one of the last of the royal families of Spain. And he's got a horse. Verdundra or something like that is this horse. And he's a killer. He's a gray stallion, a thoroughbred that he's trying to race. And that's what he does. He races. He's trying to race. But he's killing everybody. He's just absolutely crazy. He's no good at all. They can't get him in the starting gate. If they get him in the starting gate, he can beat anything. But they can't get him in the gate. So I met the man. He's a nice man. And I said, do you want me to help you with this horse? Yes, I would love you to help you. I was looking for an entry point to make a difference in Spain so that I could maybe come back and do more demonstrations and have an even more accepting audience than I had, which was pretty good. But I want more. can I fix this horse? And I went there on a Sunday. I got finished. They don't start anything till 9 o'clock at night. So I'm finished way after midnight. Got to bed at 3 in the morning. And I got up on a Sunday just before leaving to come back to the United States and went and worked with this horse. And within 20 minutes, he was saying, we'll work this out. And I got him down to the gate, and you couldn't put him through forward. He would start from about 20 feet, 30 feet from the gate, and he would just blast through the gate as fast as he could go, and you're dangling behind like a flag, you know? And, oh, man, it was crazy. I watched them try it for a while, and then I tried it, and he was no better with me. And I said, no, this is no good. And then I got him around in front and started backing him in and let him know that it was okay. And I put one of my protective blankets on him. And within 20 to 30 more minutes of work, I had him in that stall. And now I get the word today that he's doing fine and it looks like he'll race in a couple of weeks. And they say he can't be beaten. The talent is there. But that's the kind of fun that I'm having all over the world. And I'll promise you this. Travel is not fun today. But what happens when I get there is a lot of fun. And I'm working hard to justify the kind of confidence that I see here tonight with so many people coming to say, we'd like you to tell us about this little book and why it's important to us. We'd like to know what each of these horses taught you. And we'd like to know how you observe that so that we can go watch our horses. And some of the younger people here tonight, maybe they'll write their book about the horses in their life. And maybe they will remember that they learned to observe their horses by coming to a place like this. It is so unbelievably gratifying. And I am so humbled by the kind of acceptance that I've had. You have no idea. There's a young lady here tonight. Could you come up, please? The young lady that came to my place when she was 11 years of age. Is she here? Could you come up here, please? This young lady was born in California?
Yes.
But lives here now?
Yes.
And she came to my place when she was 11 years of age. And she had with her this bag. And in this bag, she put some things from my farm. And she wrote on the bag, "Don't touch," from Monty Roberts' horse place. And she put some other things on it, and she has kept this bag. And there's a drawing on this side of Monty Roberts with Shy Boy. And in it are some stones, some little stones.
They're rocks from your parking spot.
They're rocks from my parking lot. And a few flowers from around the office somewhere or something. Now, how proud do you think that makes me? And how much do you think that encourages me to get up tomorrow morning and go do my thing and keep trying to earn the kind of confidence that you show in me? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. The necklace is up here. Each of you may have already read why a necklace and what it's all about. Each horse has his own stone. There's 52 stones in that necklace, and there's 52 stones in the one in here too. And the one on this side is what my life would have been if it wasn't for the horses. Just a string. And this one, the story of my life, simply needs these 52 horses. Yeah, it could be 50 children too, but this happens to be the 52 horses. So I'll be happy to take questions now, and then I'll sign for you right after the questions. Anyone have any questions? Yes? Oh, do I work with mules much? Did you read Horse Sense for People?
No.
There's a chapter in there on Tina, the mule who won me a world's championship in reining, and I love mules. They are incredible animals. They're a whole lot smarter than horses. You don't see wire cuts on mules that much. And they say they're stubborn, but really, they're smart. And they know how to take care of themselves. And when you have a stubborn mule, you've been making ridiculous requests. And I write in that book, Horse Sense for People, I write in there about what Tina taught me. I'm running her up a hill to turn the cattle around and bring them back to a particular gate, and nobody's watching the other side. They go up that side, and I run up there and turn them back to the gate. She let me do it once each way and then gave me one extra for good measure, and then she wouldn't go up that hill again. And I said, "Tina, you've never balked in your life. What's the matter with you?" And I sat there for a minute and I thought, holy moly, I'm dumber than a mule. She knew we needed help, and I couldn't seem to get my head around it. And about that time, Alvin, my friend that was gathering cattle with me, came over the top of the hill, and he was bringing some cattle down. And instantly she said, "Well, now let's go." And we went up around him with the cattle and brought him down. And she was really working that out in her brain. And that was only about 35 years ago. And I'd already had a career. So don't call me smart. I'm still learning from my horses and my mules too. And they're great. And if any of you want, my daughter tells me now that you can come on MontyRoberts.com, www.MontyRoberts.com. And you can even get a newsletter now, and a Q&A, question and answer section there, and a lot of new stuff that's happening online. We're really working to bring you the things that you want online, and we're listening to you. If you write to us, we've got a whole team of people that are working on that, because it has to take over a little bit for my travels and my work, so that I don't have to do quite so much in that line, and I can come to you more civilized, like over the internet. I don't know how to, I've never turned a computer on or off, but they tell me they work, so we're going to keep trying it. Any other questions? Yes? The question is, are you or were you on RFD TV? I don't have it. I want to get it, but I want to get it because I want to watch you. That's really nice. So I want you to call RFD TV and tell them what you think. It's a rural outlet for television on the satellite. And this guy called me and he said, "Man, everybody's asking for your stuff. I want you to send me 14 half-hour segments." Yeah. And I said, "I don't have 14 half-hour segments. I have maybe 6 or 8 with my documentaries, my teaching videos, you know." He said, "Well, get busy and get you up to 14, because I'm going to put you on steady time slots." Okay. So I talked to my daughter who runs our business, and we worked it out. And it was, I think it was around $70,000 or $80,000 that it cost to make the additional half-hour segments. Cameramen have to be paid. Editors have to be paid. They have to do all, I don't know what all they do, but it costs money to make these things. And we sent them to him, and they started putting them on. And everybody that came to me at my signings, at my demos, "I see you on RFD. I see you on RFD. It's so great. See you on RFD. It's wonderful." And it was wonderful. Then what happened? Get a call from the guy, and he says, "If you want to do this again, I'd like 14 more, but you got to pay me $50,000 for each 14, in addition to the cost of creating the segments." I said, I can't do that. I'm non-profit. And I have a board that runs me. They're not going to let me spend probably about $150,000 a year for 14 segments. What do I get? No, he says, "We'll let you sell some advertising space on them." I don't sell advertising space. I don't know how to. I'm working. I'm doing my horses. So that's where we are with RFD. And there is advertising space, but they ought to go sell the dadgum advertising space and take my things. I'll do them for free for them, but I'm not going to pay them in addition to that and then run around asking Coca-Cola to buy an ad. I'm not in that business. Okay? I am non-profit. Yes? Animals do not think. Well, I've heard that a few times. There's some other things that I've heard too. But I've heard that one, and I say, you know, your right to believe as you believe is your right. And I don't have a right to interfere with that. Religious belief is a private thing for me. And I want you to have your religious belief. However, my religion and my horses are almost the same. And my religion doesn't say they don't think. In fact, the greatest teacher I ever had was Sister Agnes Patricia, my eighth grade teacher. And she knew that my horses thought. And if it wasn't for her, I never could have withstood the wrath of my father. But she taught me how to get through it without hating him. And she believed in me, and she believed in what I was doing with my horses, and she was a very religious lady. So some religions believe that animals think. In fact, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the leader of Dubai, is a Muslim. And he believes that animals think. And he reads every word that I write. And he watches every video that I make. And he corrects some of them too. And he's a brilliant guy. And he trains big cats and all kinds of animals. Crocodiles. I don't know how you train a crocodile, but he's working on it. And he, you know, he's so wealthy, particularly now. I mean, it was 15 or 20 years ago, he was making $8 million a day with his oil. Well, can you imagine what he's making now? I think oil at that time was selling for $12 a barrel or something. And he makes so much money, but he puts it all into his animals. And he owns more thoroughbreds and more Arabian horses than anybody in the world. And he believes that animals think. So that's two religions that I know about. But I don't want to change somebody's mind about their own religion. They can hold that if they want. There's also religions that believe, and some of you here tonight may believe, that the earth is 6,000 years old. And that's it. The earth is not millions of years old. But in my religion, and through the scientific work that I've done, I believe that the earth is millions of years old. So we have a difference of opinion. Any other questions? Yes? What did I think of Seabiscuit, the movie, and was I consulted at all? Yeah, well, two of my students helped make the movie. And Chris McCarron was one of them, whom you may know. He was a leading national jockey. He's the nation's leading jockey several years. Terrific guy. And I just happened to think that the one that was done as a documentary with the actual footage of Seabiscuit was a better one for me and closer to what was real horsemanship. And they got a little afield with the Hollywood production, I thought, ringing the bell and starting the horse in the middle of the night. You know, that stuff just didn't happen. Putting the draft horse in the stall with him, that didn't happen. The horse was around there, and he was a buddy to him, but he wasn't in the stall with him. But, you know, the movies like that, I think, help the horse industry, and I wish they'd do more, making heroes of our horses. Farlap, Seabiscuit, horses like that are heroes, and we should do more. The racing industry should play up the horses a lot more. I think the rodeo industry should make heroes of the bucking horses just like they do their bulls. The bulls are heroes today, and industries are spawned off one bull, you know. But there's some wonderful bucking horses that I think don't get enough credit. And they have a wonderful life too, and they're loved by the people that ride them, and they're not mistreated. And if they are, then the person should go to jail. That's my position. But if it's a professional outfit, they don't mistreat their bucking horses. They'll bring $30,000-$40,000 a piece. And they will buck until they're 30 years old if they're treated right. But I think they should be heroes, and I think they should be led out of the arena like heroes, I think they should be introduced like heroes. Other questions? Okay. Have I covered all the subject? Oh, is there another book? I never even brought it up.
Good question.
Yeah. You can read this, or bits and pieces out of it if you want. It'll be sitting here. It says The Horse Whisperer Saved Our School. And I'm working a lot now in prisons and youth detention centers and schools. And this was a school called Kingshurst Junior School in Birmingham, England, inner city, scheduled to be torn down because they could not produce literate children. They took my concepts on from the book, Horse Sense for People. And in 4 years, this school became a center of excellence. It went from the bottom 2% of 34,000 schools to the top 5% of 34,000, the same 34,000 schools. And now there's a book underway. I'm writing it with a teacher who made this happen. I wasn't there every day. But a teacher named Stephen Taylor, a sixth grade teacher, made this happen. He works with horses. He read my book. And he got the principal to allow him to put my concepts to work. And he made it happen. So we're writing a book together. And we're tag teaming it. I give him the concepts. And he says what he did with the concepts, and back and forth like that. And it's going to be called Monty's Principles, and it will probably be out next autumn, but I don't know if the United States will accept it. It may have to just be an English book. But we just took on the Conuctai School District in Northern California, a center of the production of methamphetamine, a dysfunctional community to the 10th power. Where the teachers fear for their lives every day, and the bus drivers will tell you that they carry a gun and that they'll use it if they have to, and that they don't mess with these kids. They'll beat the hell out of them if they don't do what they're told. And that's how I took it over, and we'll see what we can do. This one's scary because I don't really have teachers that are all that compatible, but there's a few gems in there, and human beings are not like apples. You can put a couple of good ones in the barrel, and the whole barrel can get good if you're a good enough role model. So there's probably more books in me, but I'm over 70 years old now, and I got my foot on the floor, and I'm not going to slow down till the box time. So go to my website and see what's happening. And if I'm not in the obituary column, then I know I got one more day. Okay, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Neil Gaiman, Carl Hyacin, Michael Connolly, and many more, as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was recorded on September 23rd, 2005.